Hey, Curiosity Builders, I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. Do you know what your core values are? On top of that, do your employees, even your customers, know them? Today's guest on Getting Work to Work is Darius Mirshazadeh, serial entrepreneur, core values expert, and author of The Core Value Equation, a framework to drive results, create limitless scale, and win the war for talent. In this conversation, Darius talks about his experiences in life and business that fueled his obsession to understand core values and create a technology that makes those values come to life. He gives you actionable information for powerful transformation, from discovering the themes and designing the values to operationalizing those values and turning them into your business's language. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/493. And I got to ask before we start, is that Pat Morita behind you?
Not only is that Pat Morita, it's a signed, autographed Pat Morita.
Yes, that's fantastic.
That's my favorite movie is Karate Kid. And okay. So I watched it in the theaters when I was six.
Nice.
And my wife knows that it's my favorite. So she bought it for me for Christmas. Like, I don't even, maybe my birthday or Christmas, like at least a decade ago. We've been together for 18 years. So yeah, I got my signed Mr. Miyagi.
Nice. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
We've been enjoying Cobra Kai here, so.
Oh yeah, I'm on season 3, episode 4 as of last night. I went through the first two seasons like in 2 seconds, like the day they came out. And this one, I've been so busy, I haven't had a chance. So now I'm. It's amazing, man. It's like Karate Kid plus Power Rangers.
Yeah.
Like if it's in like the motif of Power Rangers with like a little bit of like cheesy Netflix like drama. So it's a nice combination of all three.
That's right. We were watching Screen Junkies and they do Honest Trailers and they did Cobra Kai. And then for commentary, they had one of the writers of the series on the show. And it was just fantastic because, you know, everything is fair game in all the movies, they said.
I'm at the part where in the second movie where the bad guy shows up again. Have you seen?
Yeah.
I just got there last night. I'm like, what's the rating of the show? Just so I curse a lot.
Be yourself. That's all that matters.
So we're not on air. The show hasn't started yet or it started already?
It has not. So I won't use any of this.
I don't care. You can use it. I'm like, Daniel meets up with, what the hell is his Asian girlfriend name? It's like Miko or something like that.
Something like that.
And they show there. And I'm like, dude, they're going to hook up. I'm like, I know this is a family show where he's not supposed to hook up, you know, cheat on his wife.
That's
like, come on. He's in Japan. He's seen his girlfriend. He hasn't seen. She's single. There's no fucking way he's not going to hook up with her. And I'm pretty sure they don't hook up. I haven't got through it yet, but I'm like, he's not going to do it.
Yeah.
Too good of a husband.
he's turning into the protagonist now instead of the antagonist that he
was. Oh my gosh.
Well, on that healthy note, Darius, welcome to Getting Work to Work. It's so great to talk with you. And I'm glad that we started with talking about Karate Kid and Cobra Kai, because I get an insight into what you are endlessly curious about.
Endlessly curious is probably my number 4 core value, personal core value, is curiosity. So, I am endlessly curious. And it started at the ripe young age of 6 with Karate Kid.
Nice. What was it about Karate Kid that really just kind of stoked your passion and curiosity?
Well, I mean, look, in 1984, karate was pretty hip. So let's for those of us that were around back then, that was like Bruce Lee was pretty popular. Like karate was like a big deal back then, right? You know, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came out a couple years later. Like, you know, like doing karate Chuck Norris was like peak of fame. Mm-hmm. So if you go down the list, like there was a lot of things to like make you feel good about karate.
Yeah.
You had a bunch of movies back then that were karate based. And so for me, I don't know. For I was a kid, man. Like I liked Transformers. I was six. Voltron, Transformers, Karate Kid, done. You know, throwing, you know, like, and then Rocky, the Rocky movies were big. So I don't know. I've always resonated with the underdog big time. And that movie is like an underdog. It's a hero's journey, underdog, you know, Joseph Campbell, like you want me interested in something? Just give me a hero's journey with Joseph Campbell underlying story. And I'm like, oh, I'm in.
That's right.
Yeah. Throw some karate in there and some like 80s Mohawks and I'm done.
Yeah, some butt metal and you're solid, you know?
Yeah, just, I'm in.
So as you go from this, you know, being attracted to the story of the underdog, how does that lead you to becoming an expert in core values?
You know, I always say to people, core values, like I didn't find core values found me. Mm. So I was always very much a fan of the underdog. I was always the person growing up where if I was in a group of kids being dicks who were like clicky and they were being an asshole to some other kid, I would stand up for the other kid. It was like natural. Like I had this thing that happened to me when I was 13 where I lived in an upper middle class area and we were all, we had like a prom, an eighth grade prom, and all the kids afterwards were getting a limo. Hmm. Like the parents were like throwing it, you know, the, a bunch of little rich kids getting limos. Right. And so, you know, it was like $25 a kid or something. And there's like 15 kids, which like, dude, putting a bunch of 13-year-old kids in a limo is like, I wouldn't do it with my 13-year-old kid. My kid's 11 and he's not going in a limo with his 13-year-old buddies. Exactly. Like no adults. Right. Like it was like totally sketchy. Now that I think about it, now I'm saying it out loud, pretty sketchy. But there was this one kid who always got picked on. Right. And he was just a sad kid and he had low self-esteem and he was probably like, you know, came from like a more middle-class family. And I lived in an area where people were just assholes about money. And if he wasn't wearing the cool clothes and like, you know, he was just Target, right? He was a target for wearing clothes from Target. Right. Yeah. And so they invited every single, my buddies invited every single kid except him. Mm. And he's like the tag along. Right. And I was like, this is fucking wrong. I remember just thinking that. And I was like, so I was like, they're like, sorry, his name, I don't want to say his name because you might hear this, but his name, let's call him Steve. Steve was like, oh, sorry, Steve, there's no room for you. It was one of those, right? This is like it's total cliche picking on some kid.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh no, there's room for him. You can have my seat. And I was just like, I don't want to go. Mm. And I fucking meant it. Yeah. I was like, this is wrong. So that I think is probably like a good explanation of just the way I just think I've always been values, very values driven. Mm-hmm. And doing the right thing. And is just one of those things where it's like, you know, the difference between good, right and wrong. And for me, it came very naturally that regardless if other people were doing the wrong thing in groups, I was just like, that's wrong. Not doing it. I was born with that in me. And so and I was a wrestler in high school and in college, and I was the team captain. And wow. I've always just like been a natural leader. Like for me, like it's not, if there's an opportunity to lead, I run to do it. I like doing it. I don't know. It's just a natural inclination. And so I don't have to think about it. I want to do it. And I've always been, I'm in a CEO group forum, and one of my forum mates, he owns a very, very like popular snack food company called Dang, D-A-N-G. They do like coconut chips and keto bars. And they're in like 3,000 Whole Foods. And wow. And he's a millennial. I'm a Gen Xer. And so I pick on him a little bit because he's like a little brother. And his name's Andrew. Andrew, if you're listening to this, you know what I'm talking about. And so, but he said, Darius, what I love about you is you're always the first to raise your hand. And we've done stuff where we went to a thing called the Future of Masculinity, which is an interesting workshop to go to with a bunch of dudes. At Esalon, which I don't know if you know what that is, mm-mm. But it's the last scene of Mad Men where Don Draper's like in some on the beach, like
yeah.
Contemplating his life is at Esalon. He's at Esalon. Wow. And in the show, he went and it's like a hippie retreat place where they do workshops.
Okay.
So I was there with this men's group, like 70 dudes in a room talking about the future of masculinity. And they're asking some pretty woo-woo questions. And my hand's just shooting up. So my buddy's like, you're always the first to raise your hand. And I'm like, you know, it is what it is. I can't help it. You know, I have the urge, right? It's that urge to lead and that urge to push. Mm-hmm. And so when I got into entrepreneurism, that thing resonated with me. When I saw it and it meant something, I'm like, values, using values. This is back in 2006. And I was young. I was, you know, 27 years old. And I was like, using values in a business makes sense, but like I never thought about it before. So for me, it was just one of those things that kind of, it was just like itched at me and I noticed it. And, you know, it's a pretty long story, but I got obsessed about it. Yeah. You know, it became my go-to tool for high growth for a business. I've since exited that business, but it's now become my go-to tool for how I live. Like, yeah. That's my language. You know, I believe that core values have the opportunity to become the language of our organizations and of our lives. And so for me, if that's what that is, then how do I go deeper into it? How do I use it more? How do I not only just talk about it in the abstract, mm-hmm. how do I use it in a concrete way to create outcomes I want?
Yeah.
And to speed up the process of creating outcomes. So like Chris, like I'll ask you a question. Mm-hmm. Do you know what the actual dictionary definition of the word core values is?
I don't.
Okay. So funny enough, neither did I. And I wrote a fucking book on it. Okay. Okay. I obsessed about it. I just never looked it up. Like, you yeah. know, so I don't know why I didn't. I just didn't. So I went and looked it up one day, not too long ago. This is like pretty recently. And the dictionary definition of core values is it is the fundamental beliefs of a person or an organization. I'll repeat that. It is the fundamental beliefs of a person or an organization. So what's fundamental? Fundamental is the, you know, the deepest, most important beliefs. Mm-hmm. So if you get clear, and let's use business, for example, we're told we're supposed to have core values for our business. Mm-hmm. Gallup has done some studies around on this, and I think it's 9 out of 10 companies have core values in their business. 90%. 90% of companies have core values in their business. Only 11% of companies have at least 60% or more of their employees that know those core values. That's a wide disconnect,
yeah.
right? And let's take two steps back. A moment ago, I said core values are the fundamental beliefs of an organization. Yet only 11% of companies have employees that actually know them.
Yeah,
that's terrible. Now, I can honestly admit I was one of those companies at one point, and I had a moment that happened to me in my career where. When I rolled out core values, I was in this program at MIT where I learned this, and we were at the last day of graduation, and these two guys who were running this great business up in Canada called Nurse Next Door asked me and 59 other graduates of the program to stand up if our companies had core values. We were just taught in this program to have core values in our companies.
Right.
So we all stood up, and they said, please stay standing if you know your core values and can say them off the top of your head. Mm-hmm. And I sat down. And this is in June of 2008, and it was like a gut punch. Now, I wasn't the only loser that sat down. Half the room sat down, right?
Wow.
And I was like, wow, this is crazy. Half the room just sat down. So then they said, please stay standing if your employees know the core values and can say them off the top of their head. Half of the remaining half sat down. 3/4 of the room sat down. Then they said, please stay standing if your customers know your core values. The whole room sat down except the two guys on stage. Mm. And that was a very pivotal moment for me. It was a moment where I was like, wow, there's something wrong here. Now, I will tell you, it hasn't improved much. Yesterday, I was doing a talk on the book to a group of CEOs who are like super users of this type of technology. Out of the group, when I asked them if their company had core values, 100% said yes. And these are people that have coaches who promote having core value-driven organizations, design their core values. This is like, this is not like casual encounter. These are people that are like really into this stuff.
Yeah.
Right. I said, please stay standing if you know your core values. 3 out of 4 of them were standing. Okay, better than when I did it the first time 12 years ago.
Yeah.
I said, please stay standing if your employees know the core values. Only 40% of them were still standing.
Wow.
I think I told them just to answer a poll, right? Mm-hmm. This is over Zoom, so the standing is a little bit nominal. I should make them stand. Then I said, please stay standing. I use it a little different. I said, please stay standing if you actively promote your core values to your customers. And the numbers were pretty abysmal. And these are people that are taught to do it, right? These are people, and this is like my book's been out for a while. They've had a chance to read it, right? Yeah. So the reality is there's a disconnect and people just don't do a great job of bringing them to life. And for me, it just became this thing where I got bit by the core value bug. And before I knew it, man, it just became this thing that I really cared about. And the moment that really did it for me was, you know, I started a business with 3 other partners in 2013, June of 13. And there was about 30 of us. My partner had founded the company about, at that point, I think it was 17 years earlier, small business. I came in with two other partners. So there was four of us and we started growing the business. And it was very small, 30, it was in New York, it was 30 employees. I was in California, he was in New York. We grew that business from 30 to 300 employees in 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah. And here's the kicker, Chris.
Yeah.
Zero growing pains.
Wow.
Zilch. We had an 83 ENPS. 83. And for those of you guys that know NPS, the highest score you get is a positive 100. The lowest is negative 100. So 200 point scale.
Wow.
So if you're at an 80, you're like really at like 180. Because yeah. The lowest is a negative 100.
Yeah.
Put in perspective, the highest NPS in the country that year was USAA Bank. This is customer facing NPS, net promoter score. ENPS is internally with your employees. And usually ENPS is about 20 points lower than NPS. And the highest NPS in the United States was 81% by USAA Bank. I beat that internally with my team. And I was like, what the hell? How did I do that? And the reality is I'd operationalized the values. I'd turned them into the language of the organization. When people talked about doing work, they talked with the tone and the language of the values. And so for me, that was like the second moment where I was like, I'm onto something here.
Yeah.
And I spent the next 5 years nerding out on this, just obsessing about how do you design them to be better? And how do you make them go viral? And how do you make them easy to implement?
Right.
Because the trick to all this is the Japanese have a word for this that I think best exemplifies what I'm about to say is it's called shibui. Have you heard of that word before?
No, but I love it.
I had this feeling and I was like, there's gotta be like a word for this. And I went and looked up, I'm like, is there like a Japanese always are wonderful with the way they, you know, the way they think, especially around efficiency and around, you know, like making things, they have there's an intricacy about the way the Japanese think, right? So shibui means there's complexity and simplicity.
Ooh,
right? There's complexity and simplicity, yeah. Right? So minimalism is a great example of this. And I'm a designer at heart. Like, if my parents were they were nicer to me, I would have probably been like a designer. I would have been for sure. My sister went to Parsons. She's a fashion designer. There's a lot of artists in my family. I am a designer at heart. I just happen to have gotten into entrepreneurism. So I started designing organizations and I started designing values. I started designing what I call cultural assets. Mm-hmm. How do you design them for high utility value? How do you design them for high use? Mm-hmm. So what I think the gap here between people that use values and don't use values in their lives and why even today when I go to entrepreneurs who are taught this and they don't do it is I think that the system, the framework in which we take values and use them, either in our business, with our products, with our, I know you work with a bunch of creatives, with the things they're creating, the disconnect is people intuitively understand their values and they act within them for the most part, but it's abstract and it's kind of like this intuitive behavior. That's cool. Yeah. But imagine if there was massive intent around it, right? Where they say, you know, take that, think of anything great we create. We don't do it just based off of la-di-da. I'll just like go with my gut moment. You can do that in a very like minor way for like quick behaviors or, but think of big long-term projects or think of like projects of meaning. Mm-hmm. No one's done any of that just purely based on intuition.
Right.
Zero. There, like anything great took a lot of work, effort, and intent and being deliberate. And so my belief is like, why don't you just do that with values and make that, weave that into every aspect of your behavior in life? And now we don't have to like, it makes decision-making a lot easier. By the way, do you know how many decisions the human brain makes in a given day?
I'm gonna opt for a large number of like 5 to 10 to 15,000.
Yeah. Yeah. It's 35,000.
Ooh.
Psychology Today, that's their number at least, 2,200 per waking hour, right? If you sleep 6 hours a day. So how many of those decisions are we not making using values where we're just like asleep at the wheel, just like making these random decisions? And then we know when we make the wrong ones, when they rub up against our values, we start like, we put the car in reverse, we start backing away from, oh, that'd feel good.
Yeah.
So what about if we didn't do that? Because I believe all decisions are based out of values, like when we're intentional about it. And I believe when we make mistakes is when we're not paying attention and we kind of go down the wrong street and we realize, oh shoot, this doesn't feel good. I'm working outside of my values. And you know it when you're doing it. You're like, oh, this doesn't feel good. I feel gross. Like, I don't like this feeling of anxiety or neuroses. That's your body telling you, hey dude, you're out of alignment with your belief system. Yeah. So my belief is if you design them for to be viral and to be sticky in our businesses and in our lives, what ends up happening is they become the language for accountability, and they just become this thing that becomes second nature. Mm-hmm. And so in 2013, I witnessed that. I was like, whoa, how'd this happen? And then I started hearing it. I was like, oh, everyone's talking in core value language. Mm. I'm kind of an ass. So I was like, oh, I brainwashed them. This is awesome. My mom, when I was 10, was like, Darius, please use your brain for good. Like definitely could have been a cult leader. for sure. I could still start a cult. And guess what, guys, if you're listening, you might join my cult. My title for my book, values. Yeah, the core value cult. I almost named my book How to Start a Culture. And then they put in parentheses to the chur. Nice. My editor's like, or my publisher's like, yeah, you're not doing that. So yeah, it's one of those things where it just kind of intuitively made sense. And I started playing with it and doing the research. Like when I started pulling these numbers out of thin air, it's because I did the research after the fact. And I intuitively landed on it. But I believe as we have this opportunity in the past, what most organizations do is they discover their values. We talked about this before, that people just come up with these like five or six things that like, oh, courage and boldness. Right. And
a list of verbs.
Harmony and yeah, friendship first and these bullshit things. It's like, yeah, that sounds good, but is that really true? You know? And I mean, down deep, if I put a gun to your head and was like, which one are you going to do? Would you really do it? You know? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is like, I'd rather you pull the trigger, then yeah, that's probably a value of yours. You know, mm-hmm. If the answer is like, no, man, I'll throw that out in 2 seconds. And you maybe want to question how strongly you feel about that, because values hit us at our core. That's why they're called core values. Deep. This is how it resonates with us. It's how we feel. It's like that drives our decision-making, drives our behavior. It's why we get up in the morning to go do stuff. Mm-hmm. Right. And so for me, I believe that the discovery process is a well-worn path. Figuring out what's important to you, people understand that part of it.
Right.
The design part, there is none. Mm-hmm. The rollout part in our businesses, that's mediocre on a good day. And implementation is even worse. And so what ends up happening is like exactly what you would expect with that type of effort. Not much.
Yeah.
Wow. Like it's this thing on a piece of paper that no one really knows or cares about.
Yeah.
No, I'm shocked.
Well, it's not that I'm shocked, but there's something about when you say that it's about belief at your core. I mean, it transforms from just this word on the page to something so magnificent and something so powerful. And I think, you know, if anything, the last 4 years that we've seen people like connecting with their beliefs in maybe not the best way, but mm-hmm. but at the core they're aligning their belief with the systems around them, and I think we start seeing this ability to see the power of a core value in belief form and why it's good to have, you know, some checks, you know, with your core values.
Well, and in the defense of people who are at odds with each other's values, it's easy for me to say my values are different than your values, right? I think the reality is people have the same values, but apply them differently, mm. right?
Mm.
Like I do believe that there's a lot of similarity of values. Now, I do think that there is, and I did this very intense conscious leadership program called Stegan, based out of Dallas, Texas, and it's part of conscious capitalism. And one of the things we learn in there that I'm not supposed to talk about, but sorry, Rand, I'm going to talk about, Rand Stegan's the founder of that. It's called global mindsets, mm. right? So you have these global mindsets, which are baked in values. Mm-hmm. So you have autocratic mindset, you have a traditional mindset, which they call authoritarian. You have pluralistic or populist mindset, mm-hmm. and then you have strategic mindset, mm-hmm. right? And anywhere you go, I mean, there's autocratic cities, and like Miami's kind of has an autocratic vibe. New York has it, Vegas has it. Mm-hmm. Pluralistic would be probably back in the day, you would argue San Francisco, but I think it's not so much anymore because of the tech has taken over it. Mm-hmm. But San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, you know, what's the place up in Rhode Island, which has where Brown's at up there, you know, these like kind of hippie cities. Austin kind of has it.
Yeah.
Where I'm at, Boulder, you know, that's going to be more a pluralistic populist type of mindset. And they have values that are associated with that. Then you have authoritarian or more traditional, and that's going to be more like your Midwest, right? And then you have strategic, and strategic could be parts of New York City. Maybe San Francisco is more of a strategic city now, that like winner takes all, number one, smartest guy in the room wins. Whoever's the most brilliant persons, I don't care how young they are, they're the genius. Right. They're the winner. Right.
Okay.
So these tech cities are kind of like that. And so in that is a set of subset of values that level up to these like mindsets. And what's happening right now, at least when we talk about global mindsets, is you had an autocratic president. And prior to that, you had a populistic president, right? You had someone who was very, very, they called a green mindset, who had more green values, populist president, you know, just that's Obama. And then now you had an autocratic president that was more command and control, and that resonates with different people, right? And people start to like cluster around those value sets. And the belief in conscious capitalism, they give these all colors. So autocratic's red, authoritarian's blue, that's traditional's blue. So cops and like firemen are going to be more blue. Autocrats going to be like Trump, red. Mark Zuckerberg's orange. He's going to be strategic. And then like, I don't know, Mother Teresa's going to be green. She's going to be blue, or she's going to be populist, right? Like, yeah, this hippie, like it's all about giving to the people. What they say is that values level up to a different area, which is integral, which is yellow. It's all the colors put together. Mm-hmm. And when we start to look at values, it's not that one values are good or bad. It's that you need a leader that can elevate everyone up to integral, which is meeting people where they're at, not saying you're bad, I'm good. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause it's not true. It's an untruth. Right. I was talking to a friend of mine who I got in the program there, and he said, what's your color? And I said, yellow. And he's like, I don't really see you as a yellow. I'm like, I see me as a yellow. And he said, I actually see you as like a green red. Mm. Right. I'm all about the people, but I'm kind of a dick. Mm. Right. Like when I need to be. And I said, you have me wrong. I'm 40, 30, 20, 10. Right. Like I'm 40% green, 30% orange, 20% blue, 10% red. You know, I'm a little bit of, that's why I said I'm yellow. And the reality is we are all those things, but what people are, you have tribalism happening right now. And they're saying, my values, the traditional values in the United States, those are the values. Mm-hmm. Life is just more complex than that, you know? And I think what needs to happen is we need to unwind these values we've gotten attached to, mm-hmm. and say like, no, like human values are what's important. And yes, we don't need to, I mean, there's a bunch of bullshit rules that have been popping up, and it goes both ways. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, you got cancel culture, and I can't make a joke anymore that I could have made 20 years ago because that's insensitive. And at some point it's like, you know, it's like everyone just shuts the fuck up because they're like, you can't have a conversation because everything's offensive or it's PC and there's no, and that's not real life. You know, real life is not like that. You know, we need to have a medium to hash out our differences, yeah. you know, and to not point fingers and saying you suck. And in companies, my belief is we get a little more control over that. Right. Because I'm going to tell you what the values of the company are. We as a management team, because values are just the person, it's the personality of a business. It's a group, right? Personal values, that's my personality. Family values, that's our combined personality of the family. And I can kind of dictate that to a certain degree with children because I'm the boss, right? Mm-hmm. Until I'm not, right?
Exactly.
At a certain point, my kids are like, yeah, dad, screw off, right? They're so young, so they haven't done that yet, but they will.
Yeah.
In a business, we get the ability to dictate what we want to, what we believe we are. Mm-hmm. And then we get to have people opt in and opt out of that. And it's not bad. Like there's no good, I don't believe that people, when people say, oh, I had this shitty employee, I go, no, you had a person whose values didn't match your values and and you maybe didn't make sure they had the right skill sets and value sets to create value in your business. That person might be a rock star across the street if they're in the right environment with the right leadership, doing it the right way. Our job as leaders is to define what we are and then measure everyone against that and push the wrong people out and make the right people stay in for their own good.
Yeah.
I believe the way you do that is that you got to make a tournament in the language of the organization. The way you do that, at least my technology, I call my book a technology because I believe it's the technology of making values come to life, operationalize the values. It's really a technology that does that in some sense. And the way you do it is discovery is a well-worn path. You have to design for them to be viral and sticky. They have to. There's a design aspect. Like Chris, I have a question for you. Yes. How many photographs do you think were taken in the year 2010 in the whole world?
In the whole world, billions, if not trillions.
Yep. No, give me a number.
I'll just say 1 trillion.
So you're overly optimistic. It's 83 billion.
Okay. Right?
Now, I will tell you, you were close, but you were a decade off. Last year in 2020, it was 1.1 trillion.
Whew.
So I'm going to say this. Is it that we all suddenly got the urge to take up the hobby of photography?
No, it was technology.
It was, we have this thing that we put in our pocket that like takes pictures super easy. We don't have to pay for film anymore. I was a kid that grew up and you had to pay for film and go. I had to take my film. I had to make sure I don't break it. I had to go bring it to a place. They would create my pictures. It was really cool technology that it would take 24 hours for them to do it, or 1 hour photo. 1 hour. Oh, I get my photos developed in 1 hour. Can you imagine today? Hey, I'd like to take a picture, but you'll have it in 1 hour. 1 hour? What do you mean? I want 1.1 second. I can take 10 fucking pictures in 1 second. And I could print them out 1 second later, you know? So it's like, that's just what it used to be. Is it suddenly everyone's like, man, I don't know what it is, but I just feel like taking a lot of pictures now. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm a photographer. No. And by the way, smartphones existed in 2010. Mm-hmm. The number was like 20 billion 5 years earlier than that. It was like a billion in 2000. Like, no, it's became easy. So everyone just did it because it's so freaking easy now.
Yeah.
So what makes you think that we can't do that same thing with the core values? Mm-hmm. But people don't do that. They go, what are your core values? Love. steadfast, you know, harmony, you know, courage, like all the same shit.
Balance.
Shit, right? Balance.
Adventure.
Yeah, it's adventure, courage. My number six core value is balance, but I don't call it that because I believe the biggest rut, the biggest opportunity is design. Mm. Do we design them? Do we do what they did? Do I take my old Kodak snapshot and turn it into a phone that I can take pictures in 2 seconds? That is all you did, is take a function and turn it into a high utility value mm-hmm. function, right? And so the function of taking a picture in a device called a camera is now a function you take in a phone in an app called a photo app, right? I don't need a camera to do it. I don't even need a computer essentially to do it, right? That sits in my pocket, right? So it's not that we all suddenly became photographers. It's that we made it easy to take photos. And again, going back to what we said earlier, the Japanese had it right. There is complexity in simplicity. Let's make it easy. And then we get a ton of, like, we get way more high utility out of it. So my belief is you have to design your values in your organization for high utility value. And my book takes it through step by step. How do you do that? Because people, if you do that, what ends up happening is it becomes a language of the organization. When you do that, then you start cooking with gas. Because it's not like when I grew from 30 to 300 employees. And what I didn't tell you is then I grew from 300 to 1,000 employees the next 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah, this was like a legit business, right? This was like no joke. And I had no idea what I was doing. I was guessing. I doubt that. No, I knew what I was doing, but I made a lot of mistakes. And then I learned and then I fixed. What I learned was, if you go back to when the business was 30 people, how did we grow from 30 to 300 plus employees with zero growing pains? Was it because we had great training or amazing systems or some kick-ass technology?
Granola. You know,
what's that?
Granola.
Yeah, granola. Did I have like a beer garden in my office? No, man. If you walked into my office, I had 27 desks lined up next to each other. I had none of the things I just said. None. No training. P&P was garbage. My technology was mediocre. Good leadership. They liked me and my partners, but I didn't have any of these systems you need. This is in 2013. Like HR technologies that are really big now, they were in seed stage then.
Yeah.
Right. Or not even out. So there wasn't there was no Zenefits. There was none of this stuff. You were using ADP garbage, you know? So we didn't have any of that stuff. What I had was I turned the core values in the language of the organization and they did all the work for me. And that's where the lift is, where you create, and I call it invisible scale, mm-hmm. where people organically do what you want them to do, because that's just who they are. It's like, you know it when you see it. Like, everyone's been on that team where I didn't have to train that person to work hard. But let me just say this. Never in your whole life have you or anyone you've known been trained to work hard. That's an impossibility. They either wanted to do it and did it on their own or they didn't. That's it. So how do you hire for that? How do you manage for that? Find people that just work hard naturally and put them in a system where they feel safe and feel happy and train them to do their job effectively. But the first part's values. The other part's all tactical stuff. Yeah. And so for me, I got the first part really right. Because the second, and by the way, when you get the first part really right, here's what happens. Are you, do you have a significant other or anything like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a wife.
Okay, great. So I have a wife too. And when I am, I'm being an asshole and my wife's mad at me.
Yeah.
Anything I do wrong, she ruins me. Anything. Like I could literally like accidentally like, I don't know, leave like a crumb on the counter and she will be on me like white on rice. Like she will be attacking me. Right. Sorry, honey. and then there's the times when I'm aligned with her and we're like on the same page and dude, I can do everything wrong. And she doesn't give a shit. She's like, I get hall pass for like everything I do wrong because like she gives me that extra flexibility because we're aligned. We have that like connection around us being on the same page. Values are the same thing. When you build a organization that's core value driven, and when you have people who believe the same beliefs, have that trust, have that alignment, when they start making human mistakes, which humans make, I know that's a wower out there. I just totally blew everyone's mind. Humans make mistakes. Boom, boom. My brain just exploded. Darius is talking about something, and the humans make mistakes. When they make mistakes, they give each other hall passes.
Yeah.
When there's core value alignment, when they can trust each other in that way. So what ends up happening when you're small and you're growing and you don't have the systems to mitigate those mistakes or create consistency, which you don't have when you're small and growing quickly, when the human error happens, they give each other hall passes mm-hmm. because they trust each other. They are aligned with each other. There's more flexibility. You have more of a margin of error and it keeps the wheels on the bus. The system keeps, the company can keep growing quickly because the humans don't stop and fight with each other
right.
or passive aggressive or vote quietly behind the scenes to screw each other over, which by the way, people do all those things when they're pissed into business.
Right.
It's not like you're with your loved one that you can yell at them. They just shut their mouth and fuck you when you're not looking, mm-hmm. you know? And so how do you mitigate for that? My belief is just create a core value driven organization. It does the work for you just quietly. And but you got to design for it. And my book, I go into really the systems by which you roll it out, implement it, and then nurture it. And then last but not least, you measure for and to optimize, right? I always say to people, I say, your core values are your number one product, right? Mm. And so think of it like product.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, right? Totally reframing it, right?
Yeah, like if you start thinking great.
So would you think of the intention most organizations put around their values and then think, translate that. So say they did that exact same thing, mm-hmm. but did it with a product.
Yeah.
What would happen to that product?
Well, if it's Photoshop, it would get so bloated and become unusable.
Yeah. I don't even think you'd be able to log in, right? Because they don't do anything, right? So my belief is if people treated their products the way they treat the design of their values, like in general right now, you would have a bunch of shitty products that nobody would use. Mm. Yet on the product side, we go crazy. We test and focus groups and this and optimization and lean startup Eric Ries. And we're going to make sure this thing is amazing, you know? And yeah, maybe we do an MVP, but there's so much thought and energy put around it to try to get something out there to get product market fit.
Right.
But we don't do product market fit with our values in our organization. And I'm like, news to you or like earth, you know, what is it? Earth to news or whatever. It's like you have earth to Darius, your biggest expense in running a business, newsflash, it's your people.
Yeah.
It's your overhead. They're their biggest overhead is headcount. It's without question. I know it is. It's the time they're spending doing stuff, mm-hmm. but we don't put any intentional investment into getting them the right people there by intentionally designing the culture we want.
Yeah,
and the language for that's values. So I see people that do that all day long, and I'm like, that's stupid. I did it, you know. I did it for a lot, you know. I learned the hard way, you know. I blew my company. I didn't even talk about my first company. I went from 1 to 150 employees in 3 years when I was 25 years old. It was wow. the number 40 fastest growing company in America, Inc. 500. That company was the worst company to work at. It sucked. That was the company that I learned this off of.
Okay.
Yeah. So I learned the hard way. I feel your pain, people. I've been there.
Well, and that's what I love about that is you have to learn from experience, and the fact that you're taking these experiences that you've had, you're finding the nuggets of truth in them and creating systems and then measuring the effectiveness. I mean, that framework alone is powerful. And I'm curious, like you've mentioned design a little bit. what does it take to design sticky core values? That was probably my favorite chapter because you're starting to put this stuff into action. I don't want you to share all of it because I want people to buy the book, of course, but you know, what's one or two ways that we can start creating that stickiness that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, at high level is they got to be easy to remember and they got to be in the tone of the organization. And so there's this awesome quote by Mark Twain. You heard of the lightning bug quote? I'm going to pull it up. Mm-mm. You know, have you heard it before? Mark Twain quotes lightning bug. Anyone, if you, I'm going to Google it right now. So I had it up. I can't find it though. So the difference between the almost right word and the right word is really a large matter. It's the difference between the lightning bug and the lightning, right? So that's the best way I can describe that chapter. The difference between the almost right word and the right word is a really large matter. It's the difference between the lightning bug and the lightning. So what does that mean? Average company picks 5, 6. You know, if you read the book Built to Last by Collins and Porras, they say that if you look at visionary companies, they generally have between 3 and 6 values, generally less than 6, though. 4 or 5 is the number I like to have. Because they got to stand for things that are really important, but they can't stand for everything. And there's a hierarchy of values, like what is the most important thing to the organization? So it's that's the discovery part. And that's the part where you come up with words like courage and boldness and family friendly and all that stuff.
Yeah,
that's not that is a theme. That has not been, that is lightning bugs, right? We want lightning.
Yeah.
Why? Because think of yourself, like, how are you going to remember it? Boring words are boring for a reason.
That's right.
Because they bore us. Right. And like, I don't want lightning bug words. I want lightning words. Mm-hmm. You know, I want words when people read them, they're like, boom, like, damn, yeah, that says power. A lot to me. Power in those words. Mm-hmm. So they got to be easy to remember. They got to be in the tone of the organization. So let's look at my past two companies I did this with. My first company, which was the one that I grew that I didn't know what I was doing. What I didn't say is when I sat down at MIT the next morning, I rewrote my values. Mm-hmm. I talk about that in the book. And so I thought about what are the 4 things we stood for as an organization. Number one, we stood for working hard. We were a super hardworking organization. Number two, we stood for karma. Like, I was a subprime mortgage lender, which for some listeners are like, ew. And I'm like, yeah, that was me. But we were a subprime mortgage lender. That's why we grew so fast. I didn't tell you the part where we shrunk like crazy. We almost blew up and went out of business because of the meltdown that happened in 07 and 08. Yeah. So karma was a big deal. I was like, man, I'm not doing that again. That 150-person organization turned into a 10-person organization in 90 days. Mm. And so karma mattered. I didn't want to worry about being in an industry that did the wrong things. Innovation mattered to us. Mm. And last but not least, excellence. So hard work, karma, or integrity, you might say, innovation, excellence. Those were our 4 values. But we didn't call those that because those are boring words. Like another company could have those exact 4 words and you wouldn't know the difference between the two. Mm-hmm. Oh, you have integrity. I have integrity. We all have integrity.
We're like integrity buddies.
Yeah. Man, like I've yet to meet a company that said they don't have integrity. Yeah. Yeah. Core value number 2, no integrity. Cheat, lie, and steal your way to the top. Rip people off. So, funny enough, Enron's number 2 core value is integrity. For those listeners who know who Enron is, but I laugh about that. I'm like, if I didn't have integrity, would I make my second core value integrity? Probably.
Exactly.
Like that'll really get them. We translated it. You got to translate those words into sticky, memorable phrases. They have to be like think of it like copywriting. Mm-hmm. So for us, hard work became do work. Karma became live zen. Innovative became break the box. And excellence became wow everyone. Mm-hmm. Do work, live zen, break the box, wow everyone. 9 words, super easy to remember. In the tone of the organization. My next company, our 4 core values were caring, integrity again, inspiration, and service orientation. But like those are, when I say them, I almost fall asleep. I mean, they're boring words. Yet so many organizations do that. They don't design them. That's just discovery, what I just said. Discovery is just figuring out what's important to you. Mm-hmm. You have to take those words and translate them into sticky viral language, and that's the design process. So there can't be too many words. And we go into that in the book, using Miller's Law, the front of the brain, frontal lobe, the short-term memory of the brain, has a capacity to hold seven items plus or minus two. So that's Miller's law. You can remember seven items plus or minus two. So I say that's five to nine words total are what those do work, lives, and break the box while everyone. I call those headers. And I back out prepositions like that and stuff like that. So for us in the next business, we had caring, integrity, inspiration, and service orientation. And we turned those into people matter, period, strength of character, and inspiring leadership, rock solid service. And so we want to design those. Those are the anchors. And there's a lot of design. I do core value symbols and core value mascots. And we do all these fun things. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's just make the words easy to remember.
Yeah. Right?
Because again, I don't want lightning bugs. I want lightning, right? Mm-hmm. And then we want to build descriptives. And the descriptives are 4 to 8 senses used to describe, well, what does do work mean? Mm-hmm. What does people matter mean? Because I'll use people matter. In my last business, whenever I did anything that pissed off the employees, they'd say, people don't matter, Darius. They'd love, that was their favorite. People don't matter here. And I said, no, dumbass. I said, it doesn't say people. I said, it doesn't say person matters. It says people matter. This is not singular. It's plural. Just because you don't like what I'm doing doesn't mean I'm not doing the wrong thing. It means you don't like it. I have to look out for 1,000 other people besides you. So I made that plural on purpose. And by the way, let's read the descriptive together, 4 to 8 sentences. I probably didn't say dumbass. I think I just thought it. I hate it when people, I call it weaponizing core values. I hate it when they weaponize it. Cause I'm like, cause I know my intent. My intentions. Like I said, I'm the guy that when I was eighth grade, gave up my seat on the limo, you know, mm-hmm. like I'm always putting other people ahead of myself. So I would take offense when people would like say shit like that. Cause I was like, I know it's coming from a place of selfishness, you know?
That's right.
And I'm like, I'm a person that takes bullets before I give them, you know? So we'd read the descriptive together and I'd say, where does this like, tell me where, what you're having a qualm about or an issue about, where does that come into play here? Where am I not doing that? Mm-hmm. I cannot give you one example. And I had those moments where I'd say, let's read together, read out loud. I'm like, when I'm done reading this, I feel even better about my decision. Mm,
that's awesome. You know?
Because I know I'm living in these values. Well, you didn't give me leads. So I had a guy that did this to me, but it's in the book. His name wasn't really Carl, by the way. I call him Carl in the book. I'm not gonna tell you his real name, but everything else about him was true. So Carl comes up to me, Darius, you know, you not giving me leads is you not living Zen. And I said, brother, if you would do work and break the box and wow everyone, I would live Zen and give you leads. But you are lazy and you're not doing any of that stuff. So sorry. Like, you don't get to weaponize the values and tell me what integrity is. Like, I'm telling you, we're about work. You got to live all the values. You can't cherry pick them in your favor. So that's when those 4 to 8 sentences, that's when they become tools for decision-making. I didn't have to think hard about giving Carl, quote unquote, Carl leads. I knew I didn't want to give him leads. Why? He didn't do work. Mm-hmm. He didn't break the box. He didn't wow anyone. Mm. So yeah, I wasn't going to give him leads. And I didn't feel bad about it. Like, he knew what the deal was. He'd just work harder and get leads. That's where the design comes in. I'm getting ready for people to break them. My assumption is people are going to break your core values.
Yeah.
I go in assuming it. Mm-hmm. And then I design the descriptive to protect for that. Mm-hmm. So the book kind of walks through that process. I mean, I will tell you this. So I'm coming out with a workshop and a course at the end of the month that people could sign up for where if they want to build their values, that, you know, they work with me in a group setting. Cool. and there's a video course because it's pretty cool. It's a rather intricate process. Mm-hmm. Because I'm like, hey, you got to live with these things. You don't get to change them.
Right.
You know, and that's one of the tenets of designing core values. I call it the 100-year rule. Like, there's no changing them. Mm. Sorry. You can't put product in them. Can't change them. You got to live with them. And a lot of people like to fight me on that, the can't change them. And I'm like, no, they're your values. You can't change them. What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. As human beings, I have learned there's a thing called spiral dynamics. We as individuals, our values do adjust. We peel away the onion, the layers of the onion, and we get closer to our true self. Mm-hmm. Community, upbringing, you know, parents, our friends, they have a lot of effect over what we quote unquote value. And as we get older and more honest with ourselves, we start to realize what we like and don't like. And sometimes we shed some of those people because we're like, yeah, we're not aligned or we're less close to them. And we just don't share the same values, you know?
Yeah.
Businesses, it's a little bit more intentional because it shouldn't change. you know, stand for what you are. If you want to change your values, go start a new company. That's the way I look at it. So
that's awesome, man. You've given so much in this interview. Like I'm just like taking it all in. I mean, it's so deep and complex yet simple at the same time. And I'm just so grateful that you would dive into a topic as rich and complex as core values and make it accessible and make it transformative and powerful.
Thank you.
And I think the last question that I have for you, because I don't want to take any more of your time because you're just so gracious in your time. What's the story of the pink unicorn behind you?
My wife makes my son, she makes my kids and I t-shirts. My wife's very crafty and she makes cool t-shirts. And so she made me and he's now my oldest son. Well, he was always been my oldest son, but he's now 11. He was three at the time. Made us a pink unicorn t-shirts because my oldest, who was three at the time, loved My Little Pony. Hmm. I mean, he talked about My Little Pony all the time.
Yeah.
And so she made us pink unicorn t-shirts for Christmas. And I wore it to the office one day and my staff just went bananas. They were like, "We want pink unicorn t-shirts." And I was like, "Hey," it's like, "slow your roll." And so I said, "Listen, if you hit your goal for the month, I'll get you all pink unicorn t-shirts." Mm-hmm. And so they rallied and hit their goal. And so I got them all pink unicorn t-shirts. And then listen, man, I told you I could start a cult. I straight up created a pink unicorn cult. So it became the mascot of our company. And I mean, it's ridiculous. We did pink unicorn tracksuits. You walk in our company, there's 20-foot tall pink unicorn logos. It was like a sports team. Nice. We were a mortgage bank. Like it was the most boringest like business you could possibly be in. We would go to these like banking conferences. Now we were not even consumer direct. We were B2B. My clients were other banks.
Yeah.
Okay. So like, dude, a pink unicorn that you were like wearing loud and proud at a B2B mortgage banking conference. Yep. And it said, "Welcome to the pink." I built like a 10-foot long placemat format that said like, "Welcome to the pink unicorn land" or something like that. And it was just like one of those things that was cool. It was different. What it stood for, we said, "Hey, our business, our why, our core purpose was to grow happiness." And I said, "The pink unicorn stands for happiness in the mortgage business," because in that industry now is very happy because they're doing well. But 2012, 11, it took down the world economy. It was a pretty unhappy place to be. So for us, it was about bringing happiness to that industry and building a happiness for homeowners and happiness for our employees and, you know, just doing things with happiness as the intention. And the pink unicorn, it became a manifestation of happiness in the mortgage industry. So I took it with me when I left, though. I was like, "That's mine."
that's awesome. Well, you've got a bookshelf of many books behind you. If you were to pick one that just people should read and study, other than the core value equation, of course, your own book, what would you recommend?
Well, I mean, it depends. Like, what are you trying to learn? Give me a topic and I'll give you a book.
Well, I keep staring at the word makers behind you.
Oh, I don't know. You know, what's funny is I'm not the best at reading all the books behind me, but I do have them there because it makes me look smart.
Oh, I'm right there with you.
Yeah. So I'm not a maker, but, I meant it when I said Eric Ries' Lean Startup, I think is an amazing, I don't care if you're a startup or not. I read that book last year and I just love the thinking around product creation because product creation can come in many shapes and sizes. It could be for a startup or it could be for a new product you want to launch in your business. So, or for artists or for creatives, there's a little bit less of that because you're not going to test as much as you know, you might test marketing, you might test, but you're creating to be used. I do think there's an aspect of MVP though now in the creative side because the world moves so fast. Yeah. So I love that ideology that Eric Ries has around how do we create for testing because we get so much feedback now so cheaply that we should be testing, getting feedback, optimizing until you end up with the right outcomes. In the past, it was so expensive to get feedback and so slow that none of that made sense. And so for me, it totally was a mind shift for me on how do I think about business or how do I think about product or how do I think about how I spend my time? And I became less, invested in getting it perfect. It doesn't matter. You don't need to. Like, there's a lot of forgiveness. The market forgives very quickly and it punishes quickly. So don't invest as much. Get it out there and play with it. So nice. I love that book. I think it's a cool book from a maker perspective.
Nice. Well, Darius, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. I gotta say, this has been a kick-ass time. I've enjoyed it, and I've learned a ton. I'm taking a lot in, so thank you. I hope people love this.
Yeah, no, Chris, thanks for having me, man. This is fun. I love it.
If you aren't sure what your core values are, or you want to transform what you have into the language of your business, be sure to check out Darius's book, The Core Value Equation, A Framework to Drive Results, Create Limitless Scale, and Win the War for Talent. You'll find the link to buy it on Amazon on the show notes page. It will walk you through the discovery and design process, giving you tools and technologies to ultimately turn those core values into the language of your organization. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.